White versus United States of America, upon a certified question of law, David B. Hargett, Mark A. Jones, Defendant Appellant's Counsel, Michael F. Joseph, Assistant United States Attorney, Daniel T. Young, Assistant United States Attorney, Plaintiff Appellee's Counsel.
White versus United States of America, Mr. Hargett, you're going to introduce Mr. Jones, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you can do that.
All right. Good morning, Chief Justice Lemons, and may it please the court. I am David Hargett, serving as local counsel on the behalf of the appellant. It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Mark Jones, an attorney from the great state of North Carolina, who has been granted pro hoc vice status on this case, and I move that he be permitted to argue the matter on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Terry White.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jones. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Mark Jones for Terry Antonio White. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
I believe the historical record is sufficiently clear that the common law of England is adopted by Virginia, whether in 1775 or through the 1890 Houston decision, that common law now contains the notable exception to the physical force prong of common law robbery. And again, whether you think about this court's Houston decision as either confirming the exception's existence in Virginia or as incorporating that well-established exception, the result is the same, that since at least Houston, Virginia common law robbery has included the common law crimen innominatum exception. It is notable that since Houston, no appellate decision has ever questioned or challenged the existence of the exception in Virginia. Rather, in multiple cases, this court has confirmed the vitality of the exception in Virginia common law. And those cases are, of course, the Maxwell, Faldon, and Fleming decisions. It simply makes no difference that Houston, Maxwell, Faldon, and Fleming did not involve an appeal where the defendant was charged with robbery on the basis of that exception. The argument that the exception is only dicta in Virginia is not only a red herring, but more importantly, Your Honors, that argument's wrong. And here's why the argument is wrong. It's essential to look at what this court said in Houston. And on page 261 of the opinion, the court said that the crime of robbery, with its common law definition, has remained unchanged since adopted by the formation or at the formation of our state government. And this court then said, robbery in Virginia differs in no respect from a robbery purely at common law. This court then stated the elements of a robbery purely at common law, which it had just held meant that it was stating the elements of robbery in Virginia. And as part of those elements, this court unequivocally indicated that if one parts with his goods through the fear of a threatened charge of sodomy, the taking is robbery. And if this court had not been clear enough in making that statement, it then immediately described everything that it had just said as being, quote, the elements of the offense. It is not dicta. The court in Houston was saying the elements of Virginia common law robbery. Well, in this case and in the pleadings, the United States has spent a lot of ink trying to convince you that the pre-1775 English common law did not contain this exception. They're wrong, first for the reasons stated on pages 3 and 4 of our reply brief, but they're also wrong because this court in Houston already said they were wrong. But even if the exception was not a part of the common law when adopted in Virginia in 1775, this court has already answered the question of whether the exception became a part of Virginia common law before Mr. White's conviction in 2014. It did, and it hasn't somehow silently vanished since then. And if it wasn't a part of the common law, then why in the world would this court repeatedly cite to Houston as providing the elements of robbery, including this alternative means of putting the victim in sufficient fear? This court has repeatedly answered, what is Virginia robbery? And per this court, Virginia robbery is common law robbery, not bits and pieces of the common law. The government makes an argument that this is now exclusively punished and can only be punished as the crime of extortion. This is incorrect. From its inception, everybody understood that this was the unique and singular fact pattern in which this extortive conduct would cause so much fear that the contemporaneous taking of the property would be robbery. And I believe in Britt v. State, which is cited on page 12 of our opening brief, the Supreme Court of Tennessee did a very good job of describing it. The court there indicated that the British courts strove to place this exception on a ground unapproachable by any other fear of prosecution case, as if determined that it should have no other associate in the offense of robbery. But that does not mean that it wasn't and isn't still robbery at common law. Moreover, Your Honors, the plain language of Houston, Maxwell, Fleming, and Faulding show that this court understood that this unique fact pattern was robbery and not extortion. Every time this court discussed the exception, it did so in the face and the existence of all of these other anti-extortion statutes cited by the government, which were already on the books in Virginia. Yet robbery and extortion in Virginia have lived side by side for centuries, and they are now literally codified right next to each other in the most recent enactment in the code. But this court has never described this unique fact pattern as anything other than robbery. And if we're going to look to the statutory punishment for extortion to tell us what the elements of robbery common law are, what we're really looking at is to see whether or not that extortion statute has demonstrated the legislature's clear intent to abrogate the common law. And nothing inside that extortion penalty statute shows that clear intent. It simply misses the point to say that this could also be charged as extortion. This version, this conduct, this singular fact pattern in Virginia can be charged as robbery pursuant to the common law, and as this court has already so indicated.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
What about the argument that, you know, morality in Victorian times is one thing, we've traveled quite a distance since then, and so this idea of a devastating social opprobrium that supplies the intimidation and fear is really under contemporary norms not the same at a minimum. That it might, you know, such a threat might be met with shrugs of indifference or howls of derision. So on rare occasions we've looked at that, for example, the common law's treatment of women and said, look, we're just not doing that anymore. What's your response to that?
Since the inclusion of this exception in the common law, it is certainly true that society has progressed, and the United States Supreme Court has prohibited from criminally prosecuting certain non-sexual procreative acts. And so I would agree that it would not be appropriate to charge robbery on a threatened charge of sodomy or non-criminal, non-procreative sexual acts done with a consenting adult, regardless of the participant's sex or gender. But as both the Supreme Court and as this court in Toggill have already made clear, there remain many horrible sodomitical acts that both are and should be severely punished. And as to those criminal sodomy offenses, the reasons for the exception remain sound. We make a mistake if we think that sodomy is only the conduct that Lawrence v. Texas said now cannot be punished. This court has been very clear, and the law of the Commonwealth, I believe, is very clear, that there are a whole category of truly horrible offenses that are sodomy. And so I don't think that the threatened charge of sodomy as to those remaining offenses, to the extent it does, the critical question for today, though, it is not whether or not going forward this court believes this exception to be good for the Commonwealth. The certified question from the Fourth Circuit was whether or not it had been adopted as part of the Virginia common law, such that the court could make an analysis about Mr. White's 2014 conviction. Also, in thinking about the policy perspective, you know, I would point the court, as we noted in our reply brief, to the arguments of the Commonwealth in their brief in Toghill, in which they, I believe, accurately describe sodomy as never having been limited exclusively to the conduct discussed in Lawrence versus Texas, and in that case, arguing quite forcefully for the ability to continue prosecution under the statute's generally worded anti-sodomy statute.
So this is Justice Kelsey, counsel. So under the federal categorical approach to looking at crimes of violence under the state law, as I understand the Fourth Circuit precedent on the point, any conceivable modern application of our common law of robbery, which could include an offensive act, like, for example, sodomizing a minor or something worse, would be relevant to their determination at the Fourth Circuit level of the categorical test for purposes of their Armed Career Criminal Act. Am I understanding it correctly?
Correct, Your Honor. The inquiry focuses on the conduct criminalized by the state, not the conduct of the individual defendant. And so it simply doesn't matter what Mr. White did or what he was charged with. The question under the categorical approach is, if in Virginia somebody could be charged for robbery on the basis of this exception, then it is categorically overbroad, and it would not fall within the federal definition of a crime of violence. So, along that line, Your Honor, the Fourth Circuit has been clear that the burden is not on Mr. White to show, you know, successful prosecutions on that basis and under the exception in Virginia. At the same time, on page 17 of our opening brief, because of a number of factors, I think we have, you know, we just don't know how many of these there have been, A, because of the clarity of Houston, B, because there is no appeal from a guilty plea, and other lack of a right of appeal. But the real question for the court is, did this exception, even at a hypothetical and sort of intellectual level, was it a part of Virginia's common law jurisprudence? And was it there before 2014? If it was, did it disappear before that point? And if it was there, then this, for federal purposes, is not a categorical match. And the answer to the certified question is yes, under the common law jurisprudence in Virginia, because it adopted the whole common law and not just bits and pieces, even if it is, you know, nearly a hypothetical. If it's in Virginia common law, then the answer to the certified question would be yes.
You wanted to reserve 3 minutes. You're down to 2 minutes and 34 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would respectfully reserve the remainder of my time.
All right. Mr. Young, will you introduce Mr. Joseph?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Young. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia. And with the court's permission, I'd move for my colleague, Mr. Michael Joseph of the Middle District of North Carolina, who's been admitted pro hoc vice, to present oral argument on behalf of the United States.
All right, Mr. Joseph, we're happy to have you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice Lemons. My name is Michael Joseph. The first thing I'd like to say is that there's been a lot of discussion in the defendant's reply brief about sodomy and different kinds of sodomy. The only sodomy that was involved in common law was between men. That was it. And there's only two places where the defendant can say that Virginia adopted that rule. And that was either in 1776, when Virginia, in May of 1776 at the convention, when Virginia declared its independence, or as he argues, the case of Houston. And what I submit is that neither one of those applies. I submit to you that threatening an accusation of sodomy has never been the law of the Commonwealth.
And counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question.
Yes, please.
The statute we're interpreting is Code 1-200. Its statutory predecessor was not enacted in 1776. The General Assembly did not exist in 1776. In 1792, the statute of which we are now interpreting the subsequent version of was enacted. And there are many cases between 1776 and 1792 when this statute what we're interpreting was issued. And the statute in 1792 does not say, we, the General Assembly, having now won the Revolutionary War and declared ourselves a sovereign state, we're incorporating English common law, but we're backdating it 16 years. And statutes are generally speaking, and without an express exception otherwise, interpreted to deal with the events at the time of its enactment. So in 1607, there was no Commonwealth of Virginia. That didn't exist for another century. In 1776, there was no General Assembly. There was a revolutionary committee in Williamsburg meeting to declare the independence. And they agreed to a constitution which would later create a General Assembly. But the first act of the General Assembly was 1792. Do I have my dates wrong?
Your Honor, I can't quarrel with it. I do not know the answer. But I submit to you that this court has said that during the fourth year of the reign of James, that whatever was the law of England, except whether it was a local law, was the law of the Commonwealth. And that corresponds to 1776. That's my understanding. So
no, King James was 1607, not 1776. King George was 1776.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to misstate it. I was just reading. I think it was the Supreme Court, one of our cases that said the fourth year of the reign of James. So.
Right. Well, let me just think this through with you. In 1607, that provision that you're talking about was in a private charter issued by the king to a private company, the London Company of Virginia. The Commonwealth of Virginia did not exist in 1607. It didn't exist for another century. And in 1776, the Commonwealth of Virginia did not have a constitution, did not exist until they finished writing it. And the constitution was put together for them to create a General Assembly. The General Assembly was created, and then in 1792, the General Assembly acted. So I find it difficult to just completely ignore the law of common law of England in 1792 just because there were predecessors prior to the existence of the General Assembly. Can you help me out with that?
Well, what I would say to the court is that I still say that it wasn't part of the Commonwealth law because the Commonwealth didn't use that. There's been no application. Even in the case of Houston, where they recited the treatise from Bishop, there's no case. Those cases, Houston, Maxwell, Faulden, those cases didn't deal with sodomy. They had no sexual connotation whatsoever. And I would submit that if that was the first time that this court was talking about this subject, whether you could commit robbery by threatening an accusation of sodomy, surely there would have been more than just a block cite to a treatise. There would have been some mention of Jones. There would have been some mention of Hickman. There would have been some in 1784. There would have been some mention of other cases that progressed along in England that limited the application of sodomy. So what I say to the court is that I didn't mean to miscite something to this honorable court, but I would still say that there's that law, sodomy was important in England because there was the death penalty. It was a terrible thing. You could be put to death, and people were put to death. There's no evidence.
But counsel, in common law England, this is Justice Kelsey again, in common law England, if you didn't get benefit of clergy, the definition of a felony was that it was a capital offense.
Yes.
So, I mean, so that the fact that there's going to be a potential capital offense at the end of the day, absent benefit of clergy, doesn't tell you why this particular accusation was so abhorrent to the common law jurists.
Well, it may not be a definitive answer, but I think it has something to do with it. And I think it's notable that no case in the Commonwealth has arisen or in the United States. There's been no case on these shores where somebody got prosecuted for committing robbery by threatening sodomy. So all these other cases that were cited in the defendant's brief, they were just recitations similar to what happened in Houston, Caldwell. And I would submit that, Faulkner, and I would submit that if that was really the law of the state, the Commonwealth, we still see that repeated. It was last stated in 1937, 38. But this court has not said a word about that since then. And I would submit that when you look at extortion enacted in 1848, that covers whatever the evil is in threatening sodomy, accusing somebody of sodomy. That covers the waterfront. In fact, it covers more things than sodomy. It says that if you threaten to injure the person, the character, the reputation of somebody else, then that's a felony. That includes, I would submit, includes this idea of sodomy. So the General Assembly didn't say anything about we're preempting sodomy, but surely the fact that it at least fell into disuse, or it was never used by any jurisdiction in the United States. It was never used. It would be hard to say now, well, we had this mention in Houston and Baldwin and all those other cases where it was talked about, and so which I submit as dicta, because those cases didn't involve any kind of robbery. They didn't involve any kind of sex or any kind of sodomy. So a holding is usually what a court is called upon to decide. So I submit that Houston in those cases did not decide this issue. They were just reciting something they saw in a learned treatise. It didn't have any effect on the cases that were pending, and it was dicta. And I would submit that when you look at extortion and the history of extortion, the way the law developed in the Commonwealth is that Commonwealth prosecutors and judges and jurisprudents have used the extortion statute to cover this harm of sodomy and so many others. The case where the woman was accused of killing her unborn child and getting pregnant, she was a single mother, and getting pregnant, and the jury convicted her and this court affirmed. The case where there was another case the Court of Appeals dealt with where, I don't remember the exact facts, but it was having to do with, I can't remember what the case was, but the Court of Appeals also affirmed based on extortion. So what I'm saying to the court is that I guess I would go to the reasoning of the amicus brief, and that is that if Your Honor, Judge Kelsey and other members, Justice Kelsey and other members of the court feel that somehow this got into the common law at some point, and somehow it became the law of the Commonwealth, that it was there, even though it's not applied, that you have the option of deciding under your other cases whether this rule fits life and life on these shores, life in the Commonwealth. I would submit to you that threatening sodomy is like, it is archaic. I said it in my brief to the Fourth Circuit. It is an archaic concept. And just because England had that problem, and so far all we can tell is that the cases that where the problem arose were in England, and it hasn't happened in the Commonwealth, I submit, what reason would there be to expand it or recognize it? I also ask you to consider the fact that if the legislature chose to enact an extortion statute that seems to cover this type of evil, this type of crime, then this court usually gives some effect to enactments of the General Assembly. I can't say that I can point to anything where they said we consciously are doing away with sodomy exception, but it is instructive.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. One last question. As based upon your legal research, in 1792, or for that matter, 1776, in common law England, if an adult male had a sodomy relationship with a underaged male and was prosecuted for it, do you believe the court would say, well, that's not sodomy because it was with a minor?
No, Your Honor.
So Lawrence versus Texas clearly does not protect sodomy, even consensual sodomy with a minor. So where do you go from there? Because we're not dealing with writing an encyclopedia answer to the question. We're only answering one question. Is there any exception to the categorical assumption that the Fourth Circuit is asking us? And if there is an exception, yes, of course. Then that's the end of the analysis. So walk me through that, if you would.
Well, Justice Kelsey, I'm no scholar of the law, I admit it. But I would say that in the context of what's been referred to the court here, we're talking about adults, adult action, adult behavior. And there's no question that a state can protect minors.
Okay, I'm running out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me focus the question. In 1792, or for that matter, 1776, or for that matter, 1607, in common law England, could a man be charged with sodomizing a minor male?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, well then sodomy obviously is broader than your argument about Lawrence, which feeds directly into the argument about the categorical method.
Not exactly, Your Honor. I submit that what we're talking about here in these facts, in this case, and the way the common law developed, if we're talking about the Commonwealth has adopted these cases from the common law, they're all adults. All these victims are adults. So there's
I know, my point is a fortiori. I can't imagine a common law jurist saying, yeah, it's sodomy for an adult, but it's not sodomy for a minor.
There are other statutes that deal with that. There are other
about common law England, not the United States. Common law England in 1792, 1776, and 1607. Could there be a sodomy conviction for sodomizing a male sodomizing a male juvenile? And if the answer is yes, then your Lawrence argument doesn't close the loop for you, even if it were right.
It still comes down to what this court thinks is a reasonable rule. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Jones, you have 2 minutes, 28 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court again. I wanted to speak briefly about the concept of judicial abrogation that I heard the government mention just now. If we believe that this exception was in Virginia common law, either pre-1775 or through the Houston decision, the next question is, has it been abrogated? And has it been abrogated by the legislature? And has that statute shown clear legislative intent to abrogate the common law? And I don't think either the robbery punishment statute or the extortion statute show that clear legislative intent, and certainly not the type of intent that this court talked about in its Wackwitz decision, which is on page 23 of our opening brief. But I also don't think there's any basis to claim that this common law exception, this alternative means of committing robbery, has been judicially abrogated by rulings of this court. Essentially, I think that argument comes down to sort of two points. One, the previous rulings from this case are too old, and other cases more recently, younger cases, haven't mentioned the exception. But that's just not how the common law works. And while the government says there needs to be something more than a block quote citation to a treatise, I don't know what more there could be than this case in Houston saying these are the elements of a Virginia robbery. It is certainly true this court has the power to narrow the definition of Virginia common law robbery. But the question that it was asked to be answered either yes or no was whether or not a individual could be charged on the basis. And I believe, as the historical record sufficiently demonstrates that, that this court should answer the certified question in the affirmative. And seeing if there are no further questions, I'd be happy to yield the balance of my time.
All right, thank you very much. We welcome our pro hoc litigants as well, and thank you very much. Clerk will call the next case.